Well, could you first tell me, Mr. Colin Nott, where and when you were born?
I was born in London on the 30th of September 1931.
And what did your parents do?
My father was in transport.
Yes.
My mother was a housewife.
Mm-hmm. Where did they send you to school?
After primary school, I went to Cranbrook College in Ilford.
Mm-hmm.
It was a private school.
Yes.
And I was there till I left at 15.
Mm. And did you have any plans when you left school
for what
you
were going to do? None whatsoever. No, I started in an accounts office of a large company locally in Essex. And then after about a year, I moved to the city where I found I had lots of friends.
Mm-hmm. What were you doing in the city?
I started as an office boy in the firm of Pryor and Williams, a stock jobber,
mm-hmm.
and progressed through there to a blue button.
How did you get that job with Pryor and Williams?
Actually, I met a couple of guys in the street, Throgmorton Street, which I knew,
mm-hmm.
had been evacuated with, mm-hmm. and knew from school. And I said I was looking for a job with a stock jobbers or brokers. And they said that they knew that Pryor and Williams wanted one, and also Castle, a broking firm.
Mm.
And I preferred the idea of jobbing.
Mm.
I don't know why, I knew nothing about it.
Mm.
So I approached the firm of Pryor and Williams, a small company, and the manager said, yes, we like the look of you, but you'll have to see one of the partners.
Mm.
So I had to wait till the house closed at 3 o'clock, or 3:15 in those days, I think it was. 3 o'clock, I believe.
Mm.
And saw one of the partners, and he interviewed me and said, I think you've got the job.
Mm.
We'll write to you very shortly.
Mm.
And that's what they did.
Mm. Why had you been thinking about getting a job in the city?
The main reason was one of my old friends from school, we were going to a dance, I suppose we were 16. He collected me on a motorbike, brand new motorbike. And I said, well, how the hell can you afford this? He said, I've just had a bonus.
Mm.
And I said, in my ignorance, what is a bonus? And he said, well, I'm with a stockbroker, and the stockbroking firms and jobbers give bonuses.
Mm.
So I thought, well, I won't save that money in 2 years, what I was earning.
Mm.
So I thought I'd try the city.
Mm. So you got the job with Pryor and Williams.
Mm-hmm.
Any idea why they employed you?
I suppose they like the cut of my jib. The only thing was I was wearing a, if I can recall it correctly, a navy chalk stripe suit, a white shirt and a red tie, as indeed I am now. It's burgundy, which isn't me. And the partner who interviewed me said, does that have any political implications? Again, I didn't know what he was talking about.
Mm.
I really didn't.
Mm.
And he explained it, and I said, no, none whatsoever.
Mm.
Mm. And he said, I think we're going to choose you for the job, and you'll know in 2 or 3 days.
Mm.
And they chose me.
Mm. And what was your first job?
Office boy.
What did that involve?
A little bit of book work, but basically we were delivering bonds, because we dealt in foreign bonds. So as opposed to certificates, they are actual bonds.
Yes.
And there was a lot of delivering and to-ing and fro-ing. Then I was moved on to the Australian Gilts Department, which they had, because I was the only one in the whole firm that could type. They'd never seen a typewriter.
Mm.
They literally didn't have a typewriter. And receiving letters from banks, etc., dealing with Australia,
mm.
the ANZ Bank, I happened to mention to my boss that I thought it looked a bit funny writing in hand. And he said, well, we've got no one that can type. And I said, well, I can type. So I started typing letters, which quite amazed the partners when they had to sign them. They couldn't believe it. Where did these come from? And then I suppose I had that job for about a year. And then I wanted to go into the market very much and had several friends in there. And I was told of a job that was for a blue button, which is like the first step in there. At a broker's called Hedderwick.
Mm.
And I went for the interview, and they'd had, I think, about 18 people.
Mm.
It wasn't easy to get into the market then.
Mm.
And as I left, two of them shook hands with me, and they said, well, we think you've got the job.
Mm.
I got back to my office and the buzzer went to go into the partner's room, which I answered. And they jumped on me straight away and said, "We understand you've been for a job with Hedwig and that we lot stick together and we inform," which wasn't always the case. "Do you really want to go?" I said, "Well, I really want to go into the market." "Well, you should have told us." I said, "Well, you're fairly unapproachable. I can only get as far as the manager and he's not interested." So they said, "Well, if you like to hold on, I'll talk over the weekend with my brother and my father and we'll let you know next week." I said, "Okay, I'm prepared to do that, sir." And on the Monday they called me in and said, "We'll bring you in 3 months' time," or whatever it was. So I stayed with the company.
Could you describe Prior & Williams at roughly the time that you joined it? How big a firm was it?
In the foreign market, there were about 10 or 12 firms still when I went in. I think it had been the largest market in the stock exchange prior, before the war. But there must have been 10 or 12 jobbing firms. There was Prior & Williams, which was the oldest, who I was with. They had 5 partners, member dealer, 2 member dealers, and an authorised clerk, and there were 2 blue buttons. It was Dickensian, to say the least. When I arrived there 16 and a half years old, whatever I was, 17, they were the old-fashioned desks like that shape, you know, with ink wells and scratches for scratching out a mistake with ink. Very old-fashioned sort of knife. High stools, high back stools. It was Dickensian. Coke fire, you know, a couple of telephones and that was it.
How old were the partners?
They were the Hugh Williams. There was the old man, Eric Hugh Williams, who must have been 60-odd. There was his son, Anthony Hugh Williams, and Roger Hugh Williams, who must have been, I was 16, they must have been in their 40s, I suppose. And then there were 2 other partners who were not full partners, but we used to call half-commissioned men. They were partners, but they only shared on the profit that they made on their books. They didn't share in the profit that we made on the foreign books. They did Australians and South Africans. And I suppose about 12 office staff. But it was the largest or second largest of all the foreign bond market then.
And they were dealing in all the foreign bonds?
Yes, we were dealing in Chinese, Russians, Romanians, Bulgarians, Chilean bonds, all the Brazilian bonds, Antofagasta, Chile Bolivia Railway. Oh, everything foreign. City of Santa Fe, Romanians. All foreign bonds. Austrians, Belgians, all the old foreign bond market.
And how healthy was that market towards the end of the 40s?
About 1950, it was very, very quiet. And then it started brightening up because around about 53, must have been about 1953, we had the Japanese settlement, which was extremely good. They paid off in full. And then a couple of years after that, there were things called Potash, which were German-orientated. They paid off. And then the German government came in 53-54 and paid off a vast percentage of their debt, which was quite big. Not as good as the Jap settlement. Very big. And then Romania came in with a payment. Greece came in with a payment. Czechoslovakia, Poland, they all in turn made compensation, not in full, but some of them were quite good. So that wiped a lot of the market out, but then it still continued. We still dealt in Brazilian bonds and all the states, Santos, Pernambuco, Pelotas, Paraguay, all those stocks.
So at the time when you joined the firm, it was still possible to make a reasonable living out of the foreign bond market?
Yes, they made a reasonable living. But there was a lot of competition because there were there were 3 main firms. There was Prior & Williams, Mebane & Lowe, and Paul E. Shaw. Then about 6-7 lesser firms. Paul E. Shaw went broke, I'm afraid. Must have been around the Suez crisis, I would imagine. They were the first big one to fold up.
And was that connected with the Suez crisis?
I'm not too sure when the Suez crisis was. Are we talking about 1956, isn't it?
Mm.
56. They certainly finished before 1960. Mm. That might have hit them badly. Mm. Yeah, might have hit them very badly.
Mm. Mm. Do you have any memories of the partners at roughly the time?
Yes.
When you joined, how would you describe them?
Well, old man Williams, Hugh Williams, they once pinned a notice on his back, horrible murder, because he always looked so miserable. But he was a dear old man, he was a lovely old guy.
Mm-hmm.
He'd suffered quite a lot in the First World War, and although he was most severe to look at, when you got to know him, he was quite a charmer.
Mm-hmm.
The other two partners were, they're all dead now. Tony was quite feared by most people, could be very severe. He was the senior partner, the oldest son. And Roger, who was much milder, was easier to get on with, I suppose. But I was picked to work under the senior partner, and we got to know each other, and we got on quite well together.
Mm. Well, the Hugh Williams a wealthy family.
Oh, yes.
Mm.
Yes.
And had they started the firm?
Well, one of the Williams had, certainly. It was Pryor and Williams.
Mm.
In fact, to go back before I came, because the firm was well over 100 years old then, you couldn't be almost employed unless you played cricket, because one of the Grace brothers, was a partner in the company.
Mm.
And his photo used to hang in the partner's room.
Mm.
It wasn't WG, but it was his brother, I think.
Mm. Are there any other stories about the firm before you joined it that you'd heard, or did you learn anything about the firm before you'd joined?
Not really, no.
Mm.
No, I just knew there was a job on offer there,
mm.
and I asked someone what the difference between jobbing and broking was, and they didn't know. And then I asked the other guy, and he didn't know either.
So the people you asked, were brokers.
Yes.
Mm. And they simply were ignorant.
We're only 17 years old.
Yes.
They didn't have a clue.
Mm. Mm.
And I just fancied the idea. I said, well, I'd like to see what this is. Because I was told it was more or less the wholesale side.
Mm.
And I was very keen.
Mm. So after 3 months, they did give you your blue button.
Yes, what they did, I think the financial year, the year for membership starts and blue buttons in March, you see.
Mm.
So this was about December, so I had to wait. November, 3 or 4 months, because they didn't want to pay the fees twice,
mm.
which were about...
not much.
No, not for a blue button, no.
Mm. Mm. So about when was it that you went onto the floor? Was it 1948?
50. 1950.
And you say you chose to work with the senior partner.
I didn't at first. I have the feeling the senior partner didn't really want me in there, because they got one blue button and they were quite small. But the other ones must have said to him, well, if you don't, he's going to go. So they put me with the Australian side, which were just two partners, didn't have a blue button or a dealer.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked there for about 6 months. And we had an elderly man with us, been in the First World War, Mr. Beavis. And he was a member in his own right, but they'd taken him on from another firm that closed down, and they never let him deal. Although they said they wouldn't give him a book. In other words, I don't think he was up to it.
Mm.
He was quite elderly. So they decided that it'd be a good swap to put him over with the Australians
mm.
as a blue button, although he was a member, and bring me over with them.
Mm. Mm.
So I joined the main team, and within a year, I suppose, I was authorised.
Mm. What were your impressions when you first went onto the floor of the house?
Oh, a bit frightened.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was so full. I mean, you know, you were always told not to run, as they do now and did a few years back. But there was no room to run. It was absolutely packed.
Mm-hmm.
Packed solid. I mean, you could almost lose yourself going through there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I loved it. I actually, you know, immediately I got in there, I was fascinated by it.
What was it that fascinated you?
The whole idea of competition, the way they did the markets, no telephones were used, there were no boards, he wrote it up with pencil and crossed it out on a list that you used each day. And then all of a sudden you'd have one of your opposition in the market scream out, 98 bid KK, 98 bid KK, and I didn't know what he was talking about then, of course. He'd say, 99 bid 25 KK. And when I was authorised, of course I knew. And my partner would say to me, Wakeley bids 99 or Wakeley bids, and go and stuff him. And that meant you walk in and say, I'll sell you 25. And it was done like that, and he might open his mouth and bid again, or he probably wouldn't, but sometimes he did, he got it right. But the atmosphere was grand. It really was grand.
What was the Australian market like? What was the Australian
very
pitch?
Quiet. Very quiet. In fact, the first bargain I ever did was in Mitchell Cotts, which was a South African, and my second one was in, I think it was Old Search, which was Australian. That's when I was over there. That's when I shouldn't have been dealing, because it wasn't authorised, but they'd gone away. One was ill, one was away. And fortunately, the partner and the other pitch came over and went and confirmed the bargains. But I hadn't even been told that I shouldn't trade.
Was this fairly early on?
Oh, yes. Blue button, yeah.
And were you by yourself on the pitch all
day?
Yeah,
absolutely, yes.
And booking bargains?
Yes. Yes.
And did anyone come up to you and tell you that you shouldn't be doing it?
No. I'd been in there not 6 weeks, I shouldn't think. And one was on holiday, one was ill. And I was there for about 3 days on my own. And it must have been about 1 o'clock. And the senior partner walked over to me, who we didn't get on well at this. He didn't want me at the time. He wanted me over the away. And he said, is anything going on? And I said, no, sir, it's very quiet. Nothing at all. I said, oh, I've dealt half a dozen times. He said, you've done what? So I said, I dealt half a dozen times. He's not allowed to deal. I said, well, I didn't know. People asked me prices and I made them. He said, you mustn't deal. Who have you dealt with? So I showed him what I'd done. And he said, right, write them all out for me. I'll go around and confirm them, which was the correct thing to do. No, I hadn't, literally had not been told.
But you were quite confident about making a price.
Yeah, I was quite confident. I was over keen. So he went round and confirmed it, and it wasn't long after that. They said, well, you come over with us, and we'll put old Mr. Beavis over there.
Was this something that other Blue Buttons got up to occasionally?
Must have happened. Must have happened. I mean, the rules were nothing like as strict. But he got it right, because he immediately went round and confirmed the bargains.
And soon after, you say you went up to the main...
Then I went, which was only opposite, was only opposite, and that was the foreign market, which was 90% of the business, at least 90% of the business.
And what was that like? How many of you were actually standing on the pitch?
O'Father, Hugh Williams, Tony and Roger, there's three, myself and Douglas Tribe, five of us. Five. We did a good trade, a lot of business. A lot of business.
Was there a particular group of brokers who dealt in foreign bonds?
Yes. No, not in those days. Correction, not in those days, because there was so much going on in them that any firm could have traded in them. But going on years after that, there's probably about 10 firms that specialised in foreign bonds. But even so, you still get a quite small London firm that didn't have anything to do with foreign connections. We still have English clients. That had bought stock before the war, or their fathers, or indeed their grandfathers had. And they'd still come in with orders to deal, firms you wouldn't expect. But there were actually firms that did specialise in the foreign bond market, where they had connections with France, Germany, places like that, yes.
Was there anything particularly distinctive about the foreign bond market, comparing it with other markets, for example, at this time?
You had to know what you were doing.
Well, can you elaborate a bit?
Well, a lot of the stocks had sinking funds operating, which you probably know what I mean. Every now and again, they would come in to purchase stock at the market price.
This would be a particular broker working for the government?
It could be three brokers. I mean, in the case of Chilean bonds, there was lots of Chilean issues, about 30. The Chilean government used three brokers. They used Casnov. They used R. Leighton, and I can't think the other one was. It wasn't anything to do with us. We dealt with Casno. Someone dealt with Leighton. Can't think who the other company was. But then sometimes, of course, these countries got into difficulties and they didn't always fulfil their function of the sinking fund. Then the market would drop. So it was a bit of a tricky market, yes. It was a bit of a tricky market.
And what were prices like? Were they fairly depressed before the government started to pay them off?
Yes.
Can you give me a rough idea?
Well,
you
I can give
any particular examples.
I can remember Chinese bonds, for instance, being 2%. And in the boom about 4 years ago, which was on not only debt settlement hopes, which were pathetic when they came out, but also on collectors of Chinese bonds, Scripology, they went to over 100. And I never expected the Chinese government to pay 100. I thought they might pay 50 or 60. Point of fact, they've paid about 10 at the moment, and there'd be about 10 again, I should think. But they were 2 or 3%. The Russian bonds were 0.75%. It was less than a pound per £100 bond. And in point of fact, their settlement that we had a few years ago, they paid 40%, and they're going to pay a good bit more.
What was the market like for these bonds at the time? Would it have been only a specialised investor who'd want to buy a bond at that kind of price?
Yeah, I think you probably mainly got sellers, and they were people that held stock for years, or their fathers had, or deceased estates. You got a lot of that. But you did get the buyers, and you made buyers, because you said that sooner or later, one day, they are going to pay, and indeed they have.
How did you go about making buyers in those kind of circumstances?
Well, the market was very busy, and you know people that had been interested. There were certain companies outside the stock exchange that one knew was interested in certain stocks, and you talked to the broker that dealt for them, because you weren't allowed to deal with them. You talked to the broker and sometimes get an order, and then there'd be a little bit of, in the newspaper, come out, say, trade with Romania, for instance. And everyone would think, oh, they're going to pay off the Romanians. And you get an influx of people coming in saying, what do you think the hope is for paying off Romanians? And you would say, yeah, OK, it's got to happen one day, because if it doesn't, they'll never be lent any more money. And as it started off with, I think the Japanese were the first. They paid a very good settlement. People made a hell of a lot of money on Japanese bonds. I mean, they were standing at 15, 20% and they got paid off well over 100. So they said, well, what's the next one? So we said, well, probably Germany. And it was. And when they made their money on the Germans, what's next? Well, there's Greece, there's Hungary, there's Romania, there's China. And in turn, I mean, I think Czech bonds were very low, and Poland, there was only a couple of issues, and they paid off at, I think Poland paid off at 40%, Czechoslovakia at 60%, the Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, they then came into, will these ever pay? Yes, of course they will pay, and they did. I think that was in the 40s.
When the prices were very low, was it difficult for you to actually make a reasonably good turn on these bonds?
Yeah, it could all be one way as a jobber. I mean, you could just keep buying and buying and buying. I mean, I've known a case where I've had 3 million of them on the book, of the low price ones, and there wasn't a buyer in the world. So you just had to sit tight with it, lower your price a bit, try not to buy too much more, and sort of hold your water.
And was that balanced by markets or bonds that were a bit more profitable?
Yeah, you'd have more turn. It differed. You could have a turnover. I mean, we used to deal in a stock which was a very good turnover stock, which is now redeemed. Uruguay 3.5. Now that was a big market. Spanish 4% was a large market. You could do a lot of trade in those, and quite a turnover in the Chilean bonds. South Americans were the Brazilians and the Brazilian states. They could be tricky, but basically one made money on them. Unless they went into default occasionally, which they did, you made money on those too.
What happened when a default did occur?
Well, you just sit and wait. They just wouldn't pay the payment, and you just have to hold the bonds and wait. You'd mark them down, take a loss on your book position, and hope they're going to come up in the next 6 months with some money. which they normally did.
So would you find yourself hanging on to stock for very long periods?
Oh, Lord, yes. I've bought stock in out of the way, let's say, South American, say, Chile. I had this phone call when I was up in the office having a sandwich and a quick drink. I was on my own because we were very busy. We were going up it one at a time. I parked the phone from the pitch saying a certain broker wanted to see me, had a large order. So I said, send him up, and up he came, and he got this huge string of Chilean government stocks he wanted to sell. There were about 15 stocks, I suppose, different stocks, out of the 20-odd that existed in Chile. But a couple of them were municipals, which were very out of the way. Mm. So I immediately said to him, well, you can sell this 25,000 at the market price. I think they were around about 70-odd at the time, 80. You can sell this 10, you can sell that 5, going down through the list. One was very large. I said, no, you can't do much of that. I'll do 10,000. Then we come to a couple of odd stocks. I said, well, you're never going to sell that one, and you're never going to sell that one. So he said, well, can you explain to me why? I said, yes, because they have a sinking fund that does operate sometimes, but it's so small, they don't do anything at all. So he said, right, I'll deal with you. I'll leave the rest of the orders with you. And if I'm not here, it's my partner in the office that's dealing with it. He wasn't the partner. And I knew the partner very well from way back, very well indeed, although he never came into the market and he didn't deal in those stocks, he dealt in Americans, but I knew the man very well, with the same age. Within 2 or 3 days I'd phoned up or seen the deal on the floor and taken some more stock, and he mentioned these two out of the way ones. I said, no, there's not a hope in hell, but I'll try and place one of them, which I spoke to a broker and I said, look, you're going to have to wait a long time for your money, but there's a good turn on this one if you're prepared to wait. So he took it. So I did another one. Then the nasty one outstanding, I phoned up, the dealer was away, I phoned up the partner, his partner, I won't mention his name, spoke to him, and he said, what are you going to bid me for those then? So I told him. He said, I'll come back to you. I said, okay, fine. He came back within about half an hour. He said, Colin, if you take me for an idiot, they're worth a lot more than that. So I said, really? So he said, yes. I said, but I've done all the other business. I said, this is the tricky one. Well, I've done most of the business. He said, no, no. He said, I'll bid you more than I'd bid him. So I said, you've got them. No, no, I don't want them. I said, no, but you're saying I'm bidding you the wrong price. Yes, I am. I said, well, what do you think they should the bid price be? And he told me. I said, oh, fine. I said, well, you go and sell them it. And he came back half an hour later. He said, what do I do? Buy your lunch, eat my hat, or what? Because they were that bid, but for something like £1,500 stock, and he had about 16,000. So I got to hold on to those for like 7 years in order to shell them out at 6 monthly intervals.
So he didn't appreciate the actual intricacies of making a price.
What he did, he was a very clever guy, very nice man. He thought he'd better check his price, so he went to where he thought I would have gone through someone to go to, found out what the bid was, but he never asked the size of the market. So the amount he could sell was minimal. And that's why I'd knocked the bid down proportionally, because I got a hold of things for 6 or 7 years.
Well, can we go back in time, back to the foreign bond pitch when you first joined as a blue button? What was the next stage from that?
Well, I got authorised fairly quickly. I think it was about 2 years.
What was involved in being authorised?
It meant that from a blue button, you were an authorised clerk, which meant you were allowed to deal, to actually make prices and trade, but you had to have a partner on the pitch, which wasn't adhered to too strongly. What it meant was you couldn't have an authorised clerk standing here dealing day after day after day without a partner. But if the partner was with you and then one day he'd gone out for an hour, that didn't matter. There was a partner in charge of the pitch. So then one started making prices, and if you got it wrong, you got a nasty rocket from the partners. And if you got it right, they'd just say, or well done, or something like that.
Did they give you your own stocks to deal in, or were you dealing in the same stocks that the partners were?
No. was understudy to the senior partner, and my partner Doug Tribe, well, we weren't partners then, he understudied his brother. So he did his stocks with him or when he wasn't there, and I did exactly similar.
And how did the relationship work with the partner if you were both there together at the same time?
The partner and I,
yes.
Dreadful. He weren't allowed to make a price because he wanted to do it. We weren't too busy in those days, but still busy enough. But he wanted to do the whole thing. And after about a couple of years, I got a lot of friends because when I was a Blue Button, they were busy in the office at a certain stage, and to save a body from the office, they put me down checking the bargains. So I got to know an awful lot of people, because I was the only checking man for Pryor and Williams. Most of them had a couple, and I was down there virtually the whole day long. So I knew a lot of young guys my age, and a lot of us were put back up into the market, you see. So they all came over and said hello and shook hands, and he knew I knew a lot of people, and I did ask if I could do a book on my own. We both did, Douglas Tribe, and we were told no. We were understudies, and then I'd come back from lunch after a couple of years. I'd been dealing 2 or 3 years. I'd come back from lunch, and my colleague, Douglas Tribe, would say, so-and-so waiting to deal with you there, so-and-so waiting to deal with you. And they wouldn't approach the partner because they were waiting to deal.